Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democracy above all else, even stability in allied countries in the Middle East. That's the message Condoleezza Rice delivered as she wrapped up her tour of the region today. Rice took Egypt and Saudi Arabia to task for failing to uphold democratic standards such as fair elections, free speech, and the rights of women. And she called for the day when the region would embrace democracy.
We should all look to a future when every government respects the will of its citizens, because the ideal of democracy is universal.
Well, for a look at how the Arab world is responding to that sharp criticism, as well as a look at the challenges ahead, we turn first to Dominic Evans, senior Reuters correspondent in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. And Dominic, Rice met with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah last night. What was the focus of those talks?
Well, they were discussing bilateral relations. One of the main issues that Condoleezza Rice brought up was the issue of three Saudi reformers who were jailed last year for calling for a constitutional monarchy instead of an absolute monarchy in Saudi Arabia. Those three men were jailed, were sentenced last month for sentences up to 9 years.
As a matter of fact, before arriving in Saudi Arabia, Condoleezza Rice made a policy speech at the American University in Cairo, where she was, again, very critical in the lack of democracy in Arab countries. But she did single out Saudi Arabia and criticize the government for jailing these three dissidents. Here's what Rice said.
Many people pay an unfair price for exercising their basic rights. Three individuals in particular are currently imprisoned for peacefully petitioning their government. That should not be a crime in any country.
So how did the Saudi government respond?
Well, Foreign Minister Prince Saud Al Faisal gave a joint press conference with Condoleezza Rice after her talks in Riyadh. He gave her a fairly cool response on that front. He said those three men had broken the law in Saudi Arabia, and they had been judged by a court, and it was not for the government to intervene.
Adding that Saudi Arabia would use its own judgment of what changes were best in the country.
The Saudis have consistently given a message in response to foreign pressure that they will not go ahead with changes. They will not implement reform that is imposed from outside. Any changes, that political changes in Saudi Arabia and any reform must come from inside. That is their absolute position.
Well, Dominic Evans, Condoleezza Rice also said during her speech in Cairo that, and I'm going to quote here, "For 60 years, my country, the U.S., pursued stability at the expense of democracy in this region, and we achieved neither. Now we are taking a different course. We are supporting the democratic aspirations of all people." How are the Saudis interpreting that comment?
Well, I think they will certainly have noticed the change, the clear change in emphasis, the clear change in tone of the U.S. statements. On the other hand, remember that Saudi Arabia is an absolute key linchpin ally in the region as the world's biggest oil exporter. It's not a country that many people would imagine the U.S. would wish to promote instability when oil prices are already close to $60 a barrel.
Rice acknowledged past U.S. problems. She spoke of racism and a history of slavery. Her quote was, "The U.S. has no cause for false pride, and we have every reason for humiliation." But how did she respond at all to criticism of current U.S. policy?
Well, she was asked in Riyadh about the detainees in Guantanamo Bay, which is a major issue in Saudi Arabia, where more than 100 Saudis are detained there. There was some perception that there may be an element of double standards to start telling other countries about their judicial systems when there are hundreds of people detained without due legal process. Her response to that was there was a clear difference between locking up peaceful reformers, as has happened in Saudi Arabia, and detaining people who she, in her words, were captured on the battleground in places like Afghanistan.
Mm. Condoleezza Rice also spoke in Egypt, where she criticized elections there. President Hosni Mubarak has never faced opposition in the elections. He will be opening the elections in September. Is that seen as in reaction to new U.S. policy?
Well, certainly Condoleezza Rice delayed or postponed a visit that was supposed to go ahead earlier to Egypt over perceived concerns about the elections. It was after that delay that Egypt announced that it would be opening up the elections. So there was certainly some response to her position on that.
Dominic Evans, senior Reuters correspondent based in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. Dominic, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, of the three U.S. allies being pushed toward reform, the country that's received the greatest praise from Secretary Rice is Jordan. But that praise reportedly sounded hollow to some observers who say that, if anything, corruption and oppression may be getting worse in the kingdom. And some Jordanians are also concerned about what the trade of stability for democracy might mean to countries in the region that have come to depend on U.S. support. Joining us from Washington is Stephen Glane, a correspondent for Newsweek International, who recently wrote about Jordan in The Nation magazine. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And the title of the article, Kingdom of Corruption, seems to sum up your thoughts. Let's remind ourselves, King Hussein died in 1999. His son Abdullah assumed the throne. And many people assumed at that point that this young Western-trained man would be more forward-thinking, more reformist than his father. But you write, at a time when Arab regimes are at least fainting towards reform, Jordan is goose-stepping backward. Give us some examples.
Well, what we're seeing now is journalists being intimidated, journalists being brought in, coerced or bribed into revealing what stories they're working on, who they're talking to. We have dissidents who are being detained or incarcerated overnight or for several days without any credible charges. We have unions, organized labor groups that are being barred from meeting and physically harassed. So it's a climate of oppression that is really unprecedented in Jordan, and it's causing a great deal of concern and resentment.
But how different is it from Jordan under King Hussein? You quote an opposition politician named Laith Shbelat. He was commenting on the current regime, but under Hussein, he was sentenced to death in the 90s and then forgiven by the king, which was pretty much Hussein's way of operating. How is it different now?
Well, King Hussein was very good at wielding a soft hand. He would send the message that he wanted sent, and when he felt that it had been understood, then he would turn around and go to great pains to show that there are no hard feelings and that he was I'm the paternal figure here and you are members of my family and we have to hold together.
Playing both good cop and bad cop.
Right, right. King Abdullah has so far failed to live up to his father's knack for body language. He's shown much more of a heavier hand, some would say a ham fist, in dealing with these perceived threats to the regime, to the monarchy. He might turn it around, but right now there are a lot of people who are very nostalgic for his father's charisma and charm and light hand.
And what about you? Did you personally feel the difference in the climate during your last trip compared to when you lived in Jordan in the late 80s and early 90s?
Yes, I was very surprised when I walked in on a dear friend of mine who was a very respected journalist in Amman, and I walked into his office, and he turned on the television, it was CNN, and he turned up the volume. And I just to show you how naive I was and how unused to this type of behavior in Jordan I have been, I asked him why we couldn't turn off the TV or turn the music down, and he gestured that we were not alone, that our conversation was probably being listened to. This would have been unheard of in Jordan, certainly under King Hussein, and really until recently in Jordan or under the current king.
And corruption. I want to just stop you there. Let's break the situation in Jordan, as you do, into two categories, corruption and, as you've been saying, political oppression.
Right.
Tell us more about the corruption. How is it worse now than before?
Well, a lot of it has to do with this flow of money from Iraq, which is Iraq's very rich families, the oligarchs, have left Iraq to get away from the violence there, and they've set up shop temporarily, at least in Amman. So you have an enormous amount of money that's come into the country, and it's purchasing luxury goods, automobiles. There's a lot of new villas that are going up.
Wealthy Iraqis moving into Jordan is one thing, but how does that draw a line to corruption in the ruling government?
Well, there have always been, since the emergence of King Abdullah as the sovereign, talk about his relations with the Shaheen brothers, which is a family of ethnic Palestinians who did a lot of trading business in Kuwait. And returned to Jordan after King Abdullah was crowned and suddenly began getting very lucrative contracts, procurement contracts for the government. So there's been that that taint, if you will.
Is the king himself thought to be personally gaining from these corrupt business deals?
Well, he is known to have very close ties with them, and it's always been thought that the only way for a relatively obscure family to come in from nowhere and suddenly net these very lucrative contracts would be to have very powerful friends in high places. And until quite recently, they were bragging about having ties to the palace. Now, the king has also been rumored to be involved in business dealings in Jordan.
Land grabs, we hear?
Well, there are some interesting documents that are being circulated among what passes for the Jordanian dissident community. And these are government documents which instruct provincial officials in places like Aqaba, the southern port city, to re-register lands in the name of the king. Now, this is enough to fuel rumors and resentment that the king is involved in some kind of royal land grab. The government says that this is just a routine process of re-registering land for public sale. But it begs the question, why would they have to do it in the king's name? And just the fact that these documents are being circulated shows that the monarchy suffers from a credibility crisis with its own people.
How much do you think the Jordanian government is acting in reaction to politics in the region? You have the war in neighboring Iraq. Al-Qaeda leader al-Zarqawi comes from a suburb of Jordan called Zarqa, therefore
yes.
His name.
Right.
Tensions in the West Bank. Much of Jordan is Palestinian. How much is the Jordanian government not going to be able to, you know, acquiesce to the U.S. demands that it reform?
Well, it's a fair point, and Jordan has always been at the epicenter of a very dangerous neighborhood. And in fact, during the 1970s, it was extremely draconian in the face of threats to its very existence from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Having said that, the amount of frustration and grassroots resentment that its activity has engendered in the last 12 to 16 months is, I believe, endangering its credibility, if not its very survival, among what should be its core constituencies, the moderate tribes and families and what's left of the Jordanian middle class, which has always been very loyal to the throne.
Stephen Glane, correspondent for Newsweek International. His article is called Kingdom of Corruption. It appeared in the May 30th issue of The Nation magazine. You can link to it at our website, here-now.org. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And when we return, many have pointed out that since 9/11, the U.S. has been able to push Arab allies toward reform, slightly more open elections in Egypt, for instance. But one former ambassador to Jordan predicts there will be unintended consequences to the new policy of demanding democracy at all costs. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Condoleezza Rice stunned the Middle East this week, saying the U.S. has changed policy and will no longer overlook oppression and corruption in Arab allies. Well, to get an idea of how tough that policy might be to implement, we've been looking at Jordan. We just spoke with journalist Stephen Glane, who says Jordan may be going backwards, not forwards, when it comes to democracy. Well, we're joined now by Faraz Brezat. He's director of survey research at Jordan University's Center for Strategic Studies. He is in Amman, Jordan. And Dr. Brezat, tell us, first of all, has there been reaction to Stephen Glane's article there in Jordan?
Of course, there has been a great deal of reaction to it. First of all, it was circulated among the elite, especially the English-speaking elite in Amman. But the public at large, they were unaware of it. It was not really reprinted in Arabic in any form or way that I'm familiar with in Jordan.
What
so the impact it made, it remained among the elite only in Western Amman.
Well, what has been the reaction to it, your reaction, in fact, to his notion that Jordan is goose-stepping backward, fewer freedoms than under King Hussein?
Actually, there has been no significant change in freedom since 1993. Our public opinion surveys in Jordan demonstrate that clearly, that the public in Jordan, when they are asked to evaluate their level of democracy, they evaluate it around 5 out of 10, while they evaluate the United States 8 out of 10 and Israel 7.5 out of 10.
So Jordanians think they have about the same amount of democracy, a 5 out of 10 on a scale, as they had, you know, a decade ago?
Absolutely.
What about allegations of more oppression? And Stephen Glain lists journalists being intimidated or bribed into spying on colleagues.
This is nothing new.
This is not new.
The same level of repression Jordan has in 93 still exists today. And there's another thing in this regard, that we have a discourse coming from the king himself, coming from government, all about reform, all about political development and modernization. Yet we have not seen it materializing on the ground. Now, this created a public disenchantment, and there are many people who are unhappy with the way things are going.
Dr. Fares Rezat is Director of Survey Research at Jordan University's Center for Strategic Studies. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We turn now to Edward Ghanim. From 2001 to 2004, he was U.S. ambassador to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, the country's formal name. He now teaches at George Washington University. Ambassador Ghanim, thanks for joining us.
It's nice being with you today.
And what is your read on this? We hear that in a recent working visit between the King of Jordan and President Bush, President Bush took him to the woodshed over charges of corruption and oppression in Jordan. What was your sense of that meeting, first of all?
Well, I'm not privy, of course, to what went on into the Oval Office, but I have to tell you, from all of the meetings that I have sat through between the president and the king, and knowing that relationship, which is very personal and very meaningful, that doesn't read right, doesn't ring true.
Well, how do you square that with Stephen Glain's article in The Nation that we spoke of, or Richard Perle, a well-connected neoconservative, who recently listed Jordan in the same breath as Egypt and Saudi Arabia as closed political systems which bred discontented young men who are easily enticed to sacrifice their own lives in order to kill us?
Well, first of all, I think the article leaves a reader with a very, very distorted impression of the country. If a person read the article or listened to the quote you just used and then went to Jordan, I think they would be stunned and wondered if they were in the same country.
So you don't think there's more corruption than under, let's say, King Hussein?
Well, there's always been corruption in Jordan. And I think in the past 2 years, I myself became concerned that corruption, particularly as it related to the economics in Iraq, in other words, the contracting and the construction and other sorts of support contracts that were going from Jordan into Iraq, because there was money and money to be made, and unscrupulous businessmen take advantage of those kinds of situations.
Do you think there's a new U.S. policy, though, as columnists in the Daily Star are interpreting it, that at once the compact between the U.S. and its Arabian allies was, you can do what you need to do domestically at home because you at least stave off Islamic fundamentalist governments. Now the new language seems to be, we can no longer accept human rights abuses at home.
Clearly. This was clear when I was ambassador and representing the president in Jordan. It's clear to all of my colleagues who are serving still in other posts that this administration and our country, because he does represent us, intends to put a priority and an emphasis on political reform and a more open society. And that we believe that while that may have short-term consequences that would be negative, the long-term consequences, as the president said over and over, are critically important and are positive.
Is there a concern about, you know, what Rana Sabah Gargour calls in the Daily Star, constructive instability could have unintended consequences?
Well, I mean, as a diplomat, I like stability. I like to know what's going to happen. And sometimes when you stir things up, as our positions are going to do in the region, you do have unintended consequences. And believe you me, anyone who espouses a policy, even one that is good in our terms, needs to think about those unintended consequences. In fact, I'll predict this. I'll predict this administration will have a great deal of difficulty maintaining the firmer line on reform and democracy that they're espousing, particularly when it begins to contradict oil-producing prices and political stability inside countries that are providing support for a peace process. This would be Egypt and Jordan.
I mentioned Rana Sabah Gargour, again writing in the Daily Star. She also interprets the new policy by U.S. decision-makers as being a shift in argument that political violence and hostility to Washington in the region is the result of this internal repression and corruption rather than U.S. policies in the region. Your sense of that?
Well, my sense is that in the end it's our policies in the region and the attitudes of people in the region toward us. We've inserted ourselves in a dramatic way into Iraq. It's the heartland of Arabism and of Islam. And it's not going well, at least in their perceptions at all.
Yeah. Edward Ghanim, U.S. Ambassador to Jordan from 2001 to 2004. By the way, I understand that that office is not filled right now.
No, it hasn't been. It's been vacant now for a year.
Does that say anything?
Oh, it probably speaks more to the decision-making in Washington than to anything more political.
Thank you, Ambassador Ghanim.
All right.
Ambassador Ghanim is also a professor. He teaches international affairs at George Washington University. And coming up, guilty of manslaughter. The verdicts are in the KKK trial in Mississippi. Stay with us. We'll have much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. A jury in Philadelphia, Mississippi has reached a verdict in the case of former Klansman Edgar Ray Killen. The 80-year-old former preacher has been found guilty of three counts of manslaughter in the 1964 slayings of three civil rights workers. Jurors decided not to convict Killen on the more serious murder charges. The verdict comes 41 years to the day after the murders of Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, who had been registering blacks to vote in Philadelphia, Mississippi. In 1964, their deaths galvanized the civil rights movement. Today, that trial stirred up talk of the KKK. Before the decision came down today, we spoke with two residents of Philadelphia, Mississippi. First, Harlan Major, who was until recently mayor of the town and was one of just three to testify in Killen's defense. Your testimony raised a few eyebrows. There was one exchange, if I might read it as the newspaper is reporting it, you tell me if it's true. You were asked by the prosecutor, would it change your opinion of Mr. Killen's character if you knew he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan? You said, not necessarily so, and then went on to say, because the Klan did some good things.
Right.
What did you mean by that?
Okay, they would not let me finish, see, like you're kind enough to do, to answer it. And I'm 76 years old in a few months now. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Killen's 80 years old. So, but what I'm saying, I grew up in the 30s. Right here, about 20 miles out of town in the deep south, and the Klan was active in the middle 30s. No member of my family that I know of was ever a member of the Klan. But my daddy worked for $2 or $3 a day at a little country store about 18 to 20 miles outside of Philadelphia here. Well, Klan members would be at the store, and he would hear them say who they were visited last weekend or whoever they talked to. And if you had a man down there that was not in the community, not taking care of his family, if he was wasting money when the kids needed food and clothing, then the Klan would go call on him, say, hey, you take care of your family. But now there were more white people that they did that to than it was black people.
Well, this sounds like vigilantes, though.
It could be, and it was maybe organized as that such, because like I said, I was 5, 6, and 7 years old at this time.
But did you know that they also killed and murdered and lynched black people?
They were equal opportunity. Yes, ma'am. Now, I've never heard of a black person that they lynched that I knew, but I believe they did it because I've heard it. Yes, ma'am.
And as you got older, you heard that.
Yes, ma'am.
So can you see how it might have been upsetting for people to hear you say that they did some good things, knowing that they lynched black people?
Well, I can understand it when they wouldn't let me explain what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
It would upset people, and the district attorney would not let me tell what I was talking about that I just told you.
What do you think about Mr. Killen? Were you aware that he was in the Ku Klux Klan?
Not for sure. You don't know who's in it and who's not. I heard reports, and I think now he was. I'm firmly convinced that he was a member of the Klan.
Well, and why? You can testify to the whereabouts of Mr. Killen on the night of the murders.
There.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
You were at a funeral home where, sadly, your sister's child was being buried. You were overseeing the funeral.
Yes, ma'am.
For her 5-year-old child. And you say Mr. Killen was there.
He was there, but in a little bit he paid his respects and he left us.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting because you bumped into Mr. Killen on the night of the murders. It was your sister's child who was being buried. Your sister is married to the former owner of the local newspaper who pushed for reopening this case against Mr. Killen.
She married Stanley Dearborn later on, yes.
It all points to how small a town Philadelphia is.
You're right. Everybody knows everybody. At one point in time, I knew practically everybody in this city.
Given that, don't people in Philadelphia know who killed the 3 civil rights workers and whether or not Mr. Killen ordered it?
Well, I think we pretty much do.
And so, why hasn't someone come forward? You know, why aren't more people coming forward to say it?
Well, I can't answer that question now. Because, let me tell you this now, and this is kind of the feeling, and it's not right, but it was the feeling. If I organized today, where are you?
Boston, yep.
If I got out here and I'd say, hey, Boston's got a drug problem, they've got prostitution problems, the red light district needs cleaning up, and we're going to go up there and clean up that district. And if you go in and tell them we're coming to change this situation, how many of you think would come out alive? Mm-hmm. Forcing your way in where you're not wanted. And that's what this was. The South, you know, was the South. We'd never had this before. Integration was being forced upon us, you might say. But this is a tradition that had gone on for hundreds and maybe even thousands of years, and they were going to come down here and change it one summer. We resented the fact that they were down here. I didn't think they should be down here telling us, you know, what you're going to have to do. We were making progress, but we were not making progress fast enough to suit the world.
Do you think that thinking applies to the trial right now?
I think so, yes, ma'am. I think this is strictly my opinion, the people resent the fact that after 41 years, they got this old fellow, Preacher Killen, and he's in bad shape. Why bring him up when there's a half a dozen or more of them still living? And so that makes this thing useless. It's just more bad publicity for the South.
Harlan Major was recently mayor of Philadelphia, Mississippi. He was one of 3 witnesses for the defense in the trial of Edgar A. Killen. Mayor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, we turn now to James Prince. He's editor of the Neshoba Democrat. He's also co-chair of the Philadelphia Coalition, part of a push to find justice in the case of the murder of 3 civil rights workers. And, Jim, you know Mayor Major. You know his point of view. Your thoughts?
Those views are fossilized, and I am disappointed that the mayor would make those kind of statements. They certainly don't represent me, nor do they represent a majority of the people in this community.
Well, you know, it's being reported there was another fellow in the courtroom who went up and shook Mr. Killen's hands, telling him the KKK is a good Christian group, and later, if you give black people a chance, they will run you over. How many people have that point of view that the KKK was actually a, you know, pretty good organization?
I think it's a very small minority of people, less than 1%, I would presume. I think a majority of the people, 70% in this community probably, are for justice. They may be somewhat resentful of the outside influences, but I believe there's been sort of a lifting almost of this fear and this guilt and the tyranny that the Klan, one of the witnesses testified that how in 1967 he was so afraid, that he would be killed if he said a whole lot more, but he very clearly implicated Mr. Killen this week in the 64 murders of Swerner Goodman and Cheney. So I do believe the state met its burden of proof. And we'll live with what the jury says, and we'll stand behind the jury because that's our way, that's our system.
Jim Prince, editor of the Neshoba Democrat and co-chair of the Philadelphia Coalition, part of a push to find justice in the case of the three slain civil rights workers. Jim, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The premiere of the summer blockbuster War of the Worlds took place in Paris last Friday, but it was overshadowed by a news announcement from the film star Tom Cruise.
The premiere we wanted here in France because it's beautiful and it's romantic. And yes, I proposed to Kate last night.
Wow.
Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, or Tomcat as they're collectively called, have been having a very public relationship for the last couple of months. Cruise's enthusiasm was dampened this week by a comedian wielding a water pistol. And then there are the skeptics, people who believe the whole Cruise-Holmes relationship is part of a huge PR campaign for both of their summer movies. One fan has even decided that Katie Holmes is, in fact, a prisoner of that PR campaign. Sheila Cameron has started a website called FreeKatie.net. It's gaining a lot of popularity, and joining us to talk about it is site founder Sheila Cameron. Sheila, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And are you changing your tune now that the engagement has been announced?
The resistance continues.
What do you think is going on here?
I'm not sure. I'm just fascinated by the response, first of all. We're hovering right around 500,000 visitors now.
You are kidding.
No, it's just gone crazy.
And what is on the site? Just tell us a little bit about what's there.
You know, mostly it's just a place to touch base and see what the latest is on Tom and Katie.
Because you just can't get enough.
Yeah, exactly. And, I like to think of it as a sort of living, breathing celebrity magazine. You know, instead of just opening up People or Us Weekly and taking what's being spoon-fed to you, we have a place where people can read all the information and respond and have some fun this summer.
Well, and do you really think Katie Holmes is being held hostage?
No, I don't believe she's in actual peril. I think I have a lot of media experience myself, having been a producer and an executive and worked in Hollywood for a long time. And initially, I just started this as a little bit of fun at the expense of a PR campaign whirlwind. I was going to forward it to a few friends and have a good laugh. I was hoping maybe to sell 100 T-shirts. Went crazy.
Well, we should say the T-shirts are Free Katie T-shirts. How many have you sold?
Oh, we're in the thousands at this point, and from all over the world, the orders are coming in from Japan, Australia, Finland. It's just shocking.
And Katie Holmes actually seems quite happy being engaged to Tom Cruise. She is studying Scientology, which, as we know, he's very much involved in. But there's been other things around the Tom Cruise story of late. His very public spat with actress Brooke Shields. Mm-hmm. They've been batting back and forth insults. You have been in the entertainment industry for over 10 years. Is this all about PR?
You know, if it is, it isn't going very well. I really don't know. And every time I think my site is going to die down or interest is going to die down, I wake up and there's a brand new announcement and we're in the swirl again. I think part of the fun of this site and part of the fun of watching this happen is we've never really seen anything quite like this. The swirl this big with an actor who's so iconic at this point, and a general feeling of unease from the public that something just seems off.
And you're referring to Tom Cruise, and then I'm thinking that half of our listeners are saying, who's Katie Holmes?
Yeah.
I never heard about this whole thing.
And that's part of the fun, too, that, she's, you know, for a certain generation, she's America's sweetheart. We grew up with her as little Joey Potter on Dawson's Creek, and she was laying the foundation for sort of an interesting independent acting career with, you know, roles like Pieces of April. And to see her in this mix in a publicity machine, it's just been a really fascinating sort of celebrity watch.
Sheila?
Yes.
You ought to get out more.
I keep trying, and they keep doing something kooky. I've learned to never underestimate the wackiness of Hollywood.
Sheila Cameron, media executive and creator of the website FreeKatie.net. For a link, go to ours, here-now.org. Sheila, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Morgan Spurlock's critically acclaimed documentary, Super Size Me, has spawned a new book, Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America, and a new cable TV show. 30 Days is a reality show in which participants borrow someone else's lifestyle for 30 days. So a Christian agrees to live the life of a Muslim in a Detroit suburb, or an athlete agrees to go on steroids to monitor their effect. The show borrows its premise from Morgan's Super Size Me documentary. In what he called at the time a really great bad idea, Spurlock dared himself to eat all of his meals at McDonald's for a month to see what, if any, effects it would have on his health. Here's a clip from Super Size Me.
Hello, can I help you?
Yeah, could I get the double quarter pounder with cheese meal?
Large or Super Size?
I think I'm going to have to go supersize. Look at that. Look at that Coke. That barely fits in there. Oh. Look at that. Look at how big that thing is. Look how big that French fry is. That thing is like 4 feet tall. Double quarter pounder with cheese. More calories than anything. There it is. A little bit of heaven.
Well, during Morgan's month-long fling with big burgers, big fries, and big soft drinks, he interviewed health experts, lawyers, and legislators about this country's obsession with food and fat. When the movie was released, producer Andrea Shea met Morgan Spurlock at, where else, a McDonald's.
So how does it feel to be back at Mickey D's?
It feels pretty good, you know, like being back in your old stale bed. they all kind of have that same smell. You ever notice that? Kind of like deep-fried cleaning solvent. The thing is, I come in here and I just smell the food, and for me it's like, even to this day, if I smell a Big Mac, my mouth will start watering immediately and will want it, like I will crave it, but I can't eat it because I know the minute I eat it I will be completely disgusted by it. You know, like if I take a bite of a Big Mac, I'll chew it and swallow it, and I'll get this like film in my mouth, you know, that just kind of comes from their food, which I don't even know what that is. It's like I've become so hypersensitive to the food that I can't stomach it
yet. Your mouth waters.
Yeah, pretty creepy. And that's what keeps them coming back.
You said you wanted to tell a story of why Americans are overweight and fat happy, and yep. You started off doing something that's kind of amusing. It sounds amusing, at least at first, that you're going to eat only McDonald's for a month. You know, it adds great drama to your film. But did you exaggerate the effects of the fast food on your system at all?
How can I exaggerate a blood test? How can I exaggerate a lab test? What you see in the film, how I feel, what happens to me, is what happened. You know, there's no way to make this up. I can't automatically make my liver fill with fat and put enzymes out into my body. You know, over the course of the movie, I got ill. I was incredibly depressed. I had massive headaches that could only be alleviated by eating this food. So over the course of the month, you see my body completely degrade to the point of where I was, you know, so sick that my doctor was like, you need to stop because we don't know what's going to happen to you.
And also, I mean, your girlfriend is a vegan, you eat generally healthy, you're not a vegan, but you eat well. So, I mean, you started off at a certain place, and it probably shocked your system to a certain extent, whereas other people, if they kind of grew up on McDonald's...
Well, you got to look at what happened at the end of the film. You bring up a very good point, because look what happened at the very end of the movie. After my body peaked out, and the doctors told me to quit, but I kept eating. So after the 30 days, my cholesterol came down a little bit. My liver function came down a little bit. Was everything going to come back to the baseline where I started at the beginning of the movie? No, the doctors even said that wasn't going to happen. So what was going on? My body was starting to adapt to the environment that I put it in. And so now you got to think, how many people who lead this typical American lifestyle of overeating and under-exercising, their bodies aren't just living every day, but where our bodies are now adapting and surviving. You know, that's a scary thing to think about.
And there's a lot more going on in this film than just your three squares a day at McDonald's.
Yeah.
And, of course, these 30 days did provide, I think, a great framework for your film and the story you wanted to tell.
Yeah, my story is much as like the skeleton on which the entire movie was just built upon. The movie has a lot more than that. This is the one thing people just kind of latch onto, thinking that this is all that it's about. And it's a much larger examination of our culture, of fast food society, you know, this fast food world that we live in, and how it's influenced every part of our life, you know, from the way we eat to our kids eat, and, I mean, to the entire world. I mean, now American fast food culture has permeated every country around the globe.
People are saying and are going to continue continue saying that this is just some sort of another nasty reality show, kind of an experiment, and maybe even it's an extension of your MTV show, I Bet You Will, where you basically paid people money to eat jars of mayonnaise and stuff like that.
Everybody who's had these things to say about the film are from lobby groups, from groups that get paid by the food corporations to say these things.
But film reviewers also said this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And what about your motivations?
You know, I've wanted to make a feature film for a long time. You know, it's been one of my long-term goals was to make a film. I thought it was a very good idea at the right time. And I thought it was something that needed to be addressed. You know, I grew up in a house where food was very important. And I'm in a relationship, you know, where food is very important. And I think we live in a culture where we've become so distanced from our food, and there's no relationship now between us and our food. And, you know, the empty calories, you know, also go into, like, an empty life. We're not feeding ourselves beyond just this machination of eating.
And you make the link that a lot of researchers have made between the rise in obesity and to the rise of fast food here in this country. Mm-hmm. You talk to nutritionalists, cardiologists, but do you feel like you made a balanced film? Because you obviously have an agenda just hearing you speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I made a very fair film. You know, I gave McDonald's, which is the largest corporation, the whole reason is people say, you know, you can't blame McDonald's for the obesity epidemic, you know, which I don't blame McDonald's for the obesity epidemic. I never say it's McDonald's fault. McDonald's is iconic of the problem to me. They are the company that every other corporation emulates. Every other company follows their business practices. So by picking them, in my mind, I was picking the company that I believed could most easily institute change. Because if they decided to change their ways, every other company would follow. And now look what's happened. You know, since the movie showed at Sundance for the first time, 6 weeks later, they announced they were doing away with supersize options. And they said it has nothing to do with this film whatsoever. The film is having a tremendous impact. And I think I presented a film that showed the truth of what could happen to you if you, over the course of your entire life, do as most Americans do, which is overeat and under-exercise.
This movie isn't for the faint of heart. It's pretty gross at times. You vomit. You show a gastric bypass operation graphically on film. Do you think the film needed to be gross to be effective?
See, I don't think the film is gross. I think that's just certain people's feelings about it. I mean, in my mind, I think the film's very honest. I mean, we live in an extreme world right now where people are getting their stomachs cut down to the size of a small apple to control their weight. I think that the film really presents a picture that is as scary as it is, questioning.
You called McDonald's a number of times during the film to get their comments. Did they ever give you a solid reason why they wouldn't talk to you?
No, they wouldn't talk to me. You know, so I would call them and they'd say, well, maybe we could set up an interview. You know, let's see what we can do next week. Well, we'll send this around and see what people have to say. And it was the runaround. But if I could ask them a question, if I could sit down with, you know, Charlie Bell, the new CEO, if I could ask him one thing, I'd say, why doesn't the clown eat the food? Why does the clown take the kids inside and play with them and have a good old time and give it to them, but he never eats it? You know, he's tall and he's skinny, but he never eats the food.
In the film, you basically compare Ronald McDonald to a drug pusher. That's a pretty scary image.
Yeah, it works though, doesn't it?
Supersize the American way. Throw it down all day, every day.
Filmmaker Morgan Spurlock spoke to producer Andrea Shea shortly after the release of his documentary, Supersize Me. His new book is called Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. His new reality cable TV show is called 30 Days. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Supersize me. Now I can't get out of bed, so I have to order in. I'm a triple fat fatty and I have a triple chin. Supersize.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Throw it down all day, every day.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.